Coming up next, Indiana Public Broadcasting presents the Economic Club of Indiana. Author and economist Walter Williams was the May luncheon speaker. Williams is a professor at George Mason University and an occasional guest host of the Rush Limbaugh Show. Williams says he's concerned about the role of government in our economy. He thinks the government should stay out of our economic policies.
We have made a significant departure from the constitutional principles of individual freedom and limited government that made us a rich nation in the first place. And these principles of liberty were embodied in our nation through the combined institutions of private ownership of property and free enterprise.
Walter Williams talks about the role of government in a free society, next on the Economic Club of Indiana. But first, this news.
Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This week's speaker is author, columnist, and radio show host Walter Williams. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University. Williams says the government shouldn't intervene in the U.S. economy, even in times of trouble.
The title of my talk is The Legitimate Role of Government in a Free Society. Now, in the course of my comments, I'm going to say things that will depart from conventional wisdom in a very significant way. I'm going to say things that may sound mean, insensitive, uncaring, and politically incorrect. And to the extent that any of those things are true, you should feel free to raise hard questions. Don't give me any undue courtesy because I'm your guest. Raise hard questions. You need not worry about embarrassing me. I am unembarrassable, ladies and gentlemen. The only way you could possibly embarrass me is suggest I'm not pretty good in basketball. And that's a matter of ethnic pride that I take seriously. A justification for the growth of government far beyond what the founders envisioned, one justification is to promote fairness and justice. That's a worthy goal, but we might also ask, what is fairness and justice? What is the legitimate role of government in a free society? Now, let me just spend a few minutes discussing what the founders saw as the legitimate role of government. And to do that, let's turn to the rule book that they gave us, namely the United States Constitution. Now, most of what the founders saw as the role for the federal government is found in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. And let me just briefly quote sections thereof. It says, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States. Other things that Congress is authorized to do under the Constitution is to borrow money on the credit of the United States, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, to coin money, to establish post offices, post roads, and raise and support armies. The framers granted Congress taxing and spending powers for these and a few other activities. Namely, if you counted them up, there are 21 things that that Congress can do that's authorized by the United States Constitution. Now, nowhere in the Constitution do we find authority for Congress to tax and spend for up to 3/4 of what Congress taxes and spends for today. In other words, there's no constitutional authority for farm subsidies, not for bank bailouts, food stamps, not to mention midnight basketball. Now, a lot of people will say that, well, this guy Williams, he's just being too narrow in his interpretation of the Constitution, because, after all, the Constitution is a living document. Well, anyone who tells you that the Constitution is a living document is also telling you that we don't have a constitution at all. That is because for the rules of the game to mean anything, they must be fixed. And one way of looking at this is, suppose I ask you, how many of you tonight would like to play me poker and the rules be living? That is, maybe under some circumstances, my two pair can beat your full house. Now, the framers, in their wisdom, they anticipated that there might be necessary changes, so they gave us Article 5 as a means to amend the United States Constitution. Now, I think that we can safely say that we have made a significant departure from the constitutional principles of individual freedom and limited government that made us a rich nation in the first place. And these principles of liberty were embodied in our nation through the combined institutions of private ownership of property and free enterprise. Through numerous successful attacks, ladies and gentlemen, private property and free enterprise are mere skeletons of their past. And Thomas Jefferson anticipated this when he said, "The natural progress of things is for government to gain ground and for liberty to yield." Now, the best way of looking at this process of how government is gaining ground and liberty yielding is to look at government taxation and spending. Ladies and gentlemen, there's only one way to look at taxes. Taxes represent government claims on private property. And indeed, if government were to tax private property, when I say private property, I mean myself and yourselves. If they were to tax private property at 100%, they would confiscate private property. An even better measure of what government does is to look at what has happened to spending. And let's go back to 1902, for example. In 1902, expenditures at all levels of government, federal, state, and local levels of government, totaled $1.7 billion. The average taxpayer that year paid $60 in federal, state, and local taxes. In fact, from 1787 until 1920, federal expenditures were only 3% of the GNP, as opposed to today, more than 20% of the GNP. Today, the federal government spends over $3 trillion, and state and local governments spend well over $1 trillion. The average taxpayer today pays $10,000 a year in federal, state, and local taxes. Now, what's the significance of all this? Well, the significance is that as time goes on, you and I own less and less of our most valuable resource, namely ourselves and the fruits of our labor. Another way of looking at this is that from the average taxpayer works from January 1st until May 8th to pay federal, state, and local taxes. That means we're going on 5 months out of the year, and we do not have the rights to decide how the fruits of our labor will be used. Someone else makes that decision. And keep in mind that a working definition of slavery is that you work all year, and you do not have the rights to decide how the fruits of your labor will be used. Somebody else makes that decision. And another little tidbit, keep in mind, that our founders went to war with the greatest nation on the face of earth, namely Great Britain, because they did not want to work from January 1st until January 15th for King George. I think they'd be very disappointed with us. Now, in the economic sphere, the founders thought that relatively free markets, or what some people call capitalism, was the most effective social organization for the promotion of individual freedom. Indeed, capitalism, ladies and gentlemen, is defined as a system wherein individuals are free to pursue their own interests so long as they do not violate the property rights of others. There is private property in goods and services. Matter of fact, much of the original intent of the United States Constitution, as seen in the document itself, and the papers that debated the Constitution, such as the Federalist Papers, was to produce a climate in which this kind of social organization could occur, that is, private property and individual liberty. In fact, if you want to get an idea of what the framers thought about government, the federal government, read Federalist Paper 45, and it was written by James Madison, the acknowledged father of the United States Constitution. And in the Federalist Papers, for those of you who've forgotten, they were written by Hamilton, Jay, and Madison to convince the colonists to ratify the Constitution. And James Madison was explaining what power they gave the federal government. And he said, and I'm virtually quoting, he said, "The power that we gave to the federal government is few, the powers that we gave the federal government are few and well defined, and mostly restricted to external affairs. Those left with the people in the state are indefinite and numerous. And if you turn it upside down, you'd have what we have today. The powers of the federal government are indefinite and numerous. Now, the great benefit of the free enterprise system is that through private ownership of property and control, private ownership and control over private property, it minimizes the capacity of one person to coerce another person. Moreover, the coercive powers of government are limited. They're restricted to the legitimate functions of government in a free society. And what are the legitimate functions of government in a free society? Well, one is to protect you and me from international thugs violating our private property rights. So that says one legitimate function of government is to provide for national defense. Another legitimate function of government at some level is to protect us against domestic thugs violating our private property rights. So that says there should be police services provided. Other legitimate functions of government are those of enforcing constitutional order, the adjudication of disputes, and the provision of certain public goods as an economist would define them. Now, in order to pay for these constitutionally mandated and legitimate functions of government, each American is obliged to pay his share. Now, for the past half century, free enterprise and what it implies has been under unrelenting attack in our country. Americans from all walks of life, whether they realize or not, have demonstrated a deep and abiding contempt for private property and personal liberty. I think free enterprise is threatened today, somewhat ironically, not because of its failure, but because of its success. That is, capitalism has been so successful in eliminating the traditional problems of mankind, that is, pestilence, hunger, gross poverty, that all other human problems appear to us to be at once inexcusable and unbearable. The desire by many Americans to eliminate these so-called inexcusable and unbearable problems has led us away from the basic ideals and principles upon which our prosperous nation was built. In the name of other ideals, such as equality of income, sex and race balance, affordable housing, medical care, prescription drugs, energy conservation, and on, we have abandoned many personal freedoms. As a result of widespread government control over our lives, in order to achieve these so-called higher objectives, we are increasingly being subordinated to the point where considerations of personal liberty are treated as secondary or tertiary matters. They're treated as dirt in the United States. Now you might say, well, what's this guy talking about? Is it going too far saying that it's being treated as dirt? Well, consider the following. Suppose I write a letter to the United States Congress, and I tell them, my name is Walter Williams, and I am an emancipated adult. I am fully capable of taking care of my own retirement needs. If I fail to do so, let me die on the street or go begging, but stop taking money out of my paycheck for Social Security. How do you think that'd be greeted? It'd be greeted with contempt. That is, here is someone telling me how much I should set aside each week for retirement. And if I don't, I go to jail. Why don't they also tell me how much I should put aside for housing, for the kids' education, for food, for entertainment? I'm quite sure if they did the latter, we'd all view it as tyranny. But we accept the idea that somebody's going to tell us how much to put away for retirement. Now, the ultimate end of this process, ladies and gentlemen, is totalitarianism, which is nothing more than a reduced form of servitude. Now, I am not saying that we are a totalitarian nation yet. But if you ask the question, which way are we headed, tiny steps at a time, are we headed towards more personal liberty, or are we headed towards more government control over our lives? It would have to unambiguously be the latter. Now, keep in mind, if you take tiny steps towards any goal, sooner or later, you're going to reach it. And matter of fact, the great philosopher David Hume said, it's seldom that liberty of any kind is lost all at once. It's always lost bit by bit. Or it was put better by my late colleague Leonard Reed, the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education in New York City. And Leonard Reed said, if you wanted to take liberty away from Americans, you'd have to know how to cook a frog. And Leonard Reed said, you cannot cook a frog by putting on a pot of boiling water and then throwing the frog in the water, because the frog's reflexes are so quick that as soon as his feet touch the boiling water, he would hop away and be free. Leonard Reed said the way to cook a frog is to put on a pot of cold water, put the frog in the water, and heat it up bit by bit. And by the time the frog realized he was being cooked, it was too late. That's the same thing with Americans. If anybody came over here talking about taking away all of our liberties all at once, we would righteously rebel. But they can talk about taking away our liberties bit by bit. Now, the primary justification for the attack on private property, liberty, privacy, is the desire that many Americans express that government should do good. We say that government should help the homeless. Government should help failing businesses. Government should help the elderly. Government should help college students. Well, that's nice to say that, but government has no resources of its very own. What I mean by that, the programs coming out of Washington, they don't represent congressmen and senators reaching in their own pockets to send out the money. Moreover, there's no tooth fairy or Santa Claus giving them the money. So when you recognize that government has no resources of its very own, that forces you to recognize that the only way government can give one American citizen $1 is to first, through intimidation, threats, and coercion, confiscate that dollar from some other American. Now, if you think I'm being too loose with the terminology intimidation, threats, and coercion, you had April 15th to check me out on this. Now, we Americans, we support government doing things that if a private person did the identical thing, we would roundly condemn him as a low-down, ordinary, despicable thief. For example, I could see an elderly lady sleeping out on the grate in the dead of winter. She needs some medical attention, some shelter, some food. Now, I could walk up to any one of you with a gun in my hand and say, give me your $200. And having gotten your $200, I can go down and buy the lady some medical attention, some food, and some shelter. Would you find me guilty of a crime? Yes, you would, wouldn't you? I'd be guilty of theft. Because what is theft? Theft is taking the rightful property of one person and giving it to another to whom it does not belong. Now, most Americans can agree with me on that. But here's the problem. Is there any conceptual distinction between that act and when the agents of the United States Congress, namely the IRS, comes up to me and says, Williams, you know that $200 you made last week, that you planned to buy a nice bottle of Lafite Rothschild Bordeaux wine with it? You will not do that. You'll give it to us, and we will go downtown and help the lady out. I assert that there's no conceptual distinction between those two acts. And if you press me for a distinction, the only one I can find that ought to be trivial to moral people is that the first act, where I walked up to one of you with a gun, that is illegal theft. The second act is legal theft. It's just a matter of legality, because both acts involve taking what belongs to one person and giving it to another to whom it does not belong. Now, you might say, well, Williams, it's legal. Well, moral people cannot be guided by legality alone, because there are many things in this world that were or are legal but clearly immoral. That is, slavery was legal. Did that make it moral? The Nazi persecution of Jews, the Stalinist purges, the Maoist purges, they were all legal. But were they moral? So the moral question that you and I must ask is there a moral case for taking what belongs to one American and giving it to another to whom it does not belong? Now, in my 72 years of life, I know I don't look like it to you, my 72 years of life, I have not come up with a moral reason for that. Now, keep in mind, that I believe, let me make it clear, I believe in helping our fellow man in need. But I think reaching into one's own pockets to help one's fellow man in need is worthy, is praiseworthy and laudable. Reaching into somebody else's pockets to help your fellow man in need, I think it's despicable and worthy of condemnation. Now, in a free society, we would like for all of our relationships to be voluntary, and we want to minimize involuntary exchange. Now, a lot of people get hung up on voluntary versus involuntary. I always tell people, I love seduction, any kind of seduction, because that's voluntary. That's what voluntary exchange is. Let me give you an example of seduction. Seduction is when we proposition our fellow man in the following way. We proposition him, if you make me feel good, I'll make you feel good. Now, that's what I do when I walk into my grocer. I have $5 in my hand. I proposition him, if you make me feel good, give me that gallon of milk, I'll make you feel good, give you the $5. He's better off because he valued the $5 more than the milk. I'm that better off because I value the milk more than $5. For those of you who forget, remember your statistics, we call that a positive-sum game. Rape is like involuntary exchange. What's the essence of rape? The essence of rape is when we proposition our fellow man in the following way. We say to him, if you don't make me feel good, I'm going to make you feel bad. That would be an example. That would be when I walked into the grocer with a gun in my hand. And I say, if you don't make me feel good, give me that gallon of milk, I'm going to make you feel bad, blow your brains out. That's a zero-sum game. Now, in free markets, or in capitalism, it's all mostly, for the most part, a positive-sum game where there's voluntary exchange. Now, the free market is roundly denounced by today's defenders of what I call the new human rights. These defenders are the chief supporters of reduced private property rights, reduced rights to profits. They're anti-competition and pro-monopoly. These people in our country and other places in the world, they believe that they have been ordained to forcibly impose that wisdom on the masses. Now, of course, these people who want to impose their wisdom on us, they have what they consider to be good reasons for restricting the freedoms of others. But I'm here to tell you that every tyrant that has ever existed has had what the tyrant believed to be good reasons to restrict the freedom of others. These people want to attack the free market. Now, why do tyrants want to attack the free market? Well, tyrants do not trust that people behaving voluntarily will do what the tyrant thinks that they ought to do. So they want to replace the market with economic planning or industrial planning. And I'll give you a definition of economic planning that will last you the rest of your lives. Economic planning is nothing more than the forcible superseding of somebody else's plan by the powerful elite. Let me give you an example of that. I might plan to buy a Honda motorcycle from a Japanese producer. The powerful elite will say, Williams, we're going to supersede your plan through tariffs and quotas because we think you ought to buy a Harley Davidson. My daughter might plan to work for the hardware store guy down the street for $4 an hour. She says it's okay. Hardware store guy says it's okay. Her mother says it's okay. Her father says it's okay. But the powerful elite will say, we're going to supersede that plan because it's not being transacted at the prices we think it ought to be transacted at, currently the current minimum wage. Now, do-gooders do all this in the name of good. But what do-gooders do not recognize is that most good is not done in the name of good. If you were to ask me, Williams, what's that human motivation that gets the most wonderful wonderful things done? I would say greed. I love greed. I'm not talking about ripping off people, robbing, fraud, misrepresentation. I'm talking about people trying to get more for themselves. That's the motivation that gets wonderful things done. Now, you might not think of it this way. Now, you had this winter, you had Texas cattle ranchers getting up in the middle of the night, running down stray cows, trying to feed them, maybe trying to inoculate them, maybe getting kicked in the face by the cow. making this personal sacrifice so that New Yorkers will have beef on their shelves. You have Idaho potato farmers getting out, working, doing backbreaking work, sun beating down on them, dirt underneath their fingernails, making this personal sacrifice so that New Yorkers will also have potatoes on their shelves. Now, ladies and gentlemen, why do you think they're doing that? Do you think they're doing that because they love New Yorkers? They may hate New Yorkers. I'm not that wild about New Yorkers myself. But they make sure that beef and potatoes gets New York every single day. Why? Because they love themselves. They want more for themselves. Now, I ask you, how much beef and potatoes do you think New Yorkers would get if it all depended on human love and kindness? I'd be worried about it. I think another wonderful thing, most of you have automobiles. Do you think you have that automobile because some Detroit assembly line workers care about you? They don't give a damn about you. And if you met, you might even start fighting and cursing each other out. But why do they provide that? Because they want more for themselves. And this was Adam Smith was talking about in The Wealth of Nations. The public good is promoted mostly by the private interests. Let me give you another example of the virtue of greed. And, some people say, William, since you're trying to win friends and influence people, instead of saying greed, why don't you say enlightened self-interest? I like greed better, but enlightened self-interest is okay. You know, let me give you just one more example. Sometimes people ask me about future generations. I say, I don't care about future generations. I don't give a hoot about future generations. And so people say, well, why, William? So how come you don't care about future generations? I ask, what have future generations ever done for me? And if they haven't done anything for me, how then am I obliged to do anything for them? Where's the quid pro quo? But however, if you watch my actual behavior, my behavior would belie the sentiment. I have a nice spread in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And several years ago, I took $400 or $500 and planted some seedlings around my property. Now, that $400 or $500, I could have purchased 2 bottles of Chateau de Chem Sauternes wine and consumed selfishly all by myself. But I took that $400 or $500 and planted some trees. Now, when those trees reach their full maturity, I'll be dead. There'll be some 20, 50 kids swinging in my tree, eating my apples and my pears. Mrs. Williams made extensive improvements on our house. A huge sunroom. That's going to outlast us. And some 20, 50 kids going to be tracking mud in my sunroom. Now, the question is, what's at least some of the reason I made a sacrifice of current consumption to provide a good that's going to long outlast me, that somebody else is going to benefit from? It's very easy. The nicer my house is, the longer it will provide housing services, what? The higher the price I get when I sell the house. That is, by pursuing my own narrow, selfish interests, I can't help but make a house available for a future generation, whether I mean to or not. So, if you care about conservation, let me just one more example. You people look like nice people. I don't know whether you're nice or not. But some of you could be concerned about the extinction of various animals, of various species. I don't give a hoot. And the reason is a practical one, because according to biologists, 93% of everything that has ever lived on Earth is now extinct. And so I say, you know, why quibble about 93.1, 0.2, whatever? But some people are so concerned. Yeah, they form bald eagle clubs. You know, matter of fact, I was 35 years old when I saw my first bald eagle. I was looking at the critter in the cage. And I just asked myself, could I have gone another 35 years without seeing it? And so I concluded, yes. But different people have different values, and I can understand that. But anyway, the point of this is that I was listening to NPR some years ago, and the people were picketing the UN because they're concerned about the extinction of the rhino, the extinction of the gorilla, and other animals. They're forming Ducks Unlimited, Save the Whale Clubs. So I wrote down this list of animals that they were concerned about. And then I wrote down another list of animals that are very, very valuable to us. I say, how come people are not marching for the chicken? How come they're not forming pig clubs? Now, what's the essential difference between this list of animals, rhinos, gorillas, giraffes, and this list of animals, cows, sheep, pigs, chickens? The answer is very easy. With this list of animals, cows, chickens, and pigs, they belong to somebody. Somebody's personal private wealth is at stake. With this other list of animals, they don't belong to anybody. Nobody's personal private wealth is at stake. For those of you interested in keeping certain animals alive, I suggest that you privatize them. Now you notice in my talk I'm skipping pages because I have only a brief time here, and so that means that you're going to spend the rest of your life without knowing these things. But almost every group in our society has come to feel that the government owes them a special privilege. And we see this in this election. That is, manufacturers feel that government should owes them protective tariffs, that is, keep foreign goods out so they can charge you and me higher prices. Farmers feel that government should give them crop subsidies, take my money and your money and give it to them. Organized labor feels that government should keep their jobs protected from those who are not members of unions. College professors and intellectuals feel that government should give them funds for research. You know, college professors love to get research money to do, $500,000, $400,000 grants to do studies on poverty and have meetings in Miami during the winter at a nice hotel talk about poor people. They love it. Now, so what's the problem? Well, the problem can be found if we look at H.L. Mencken's definition of an election. H.L. Mencken was a political satirist with Baltimore Sun, and someone asked H.L. Mencken, what's the definition of an election? And H.L. Mencken said, government is a broker in pillage, and every election is an advance auction on the sale of stolen property. Now, to the extent that H.L. Mencken is correct, we've identified our problem. A lot of us want to blame politicians, but ladies and gentlemen, politicians are doing precisely what you and I send them to office to do. And we send them to office to take the property of one American and bring it back to us. And you say, hey, you're insulting us of the Hoosier state. Not in Indiana. We don't do that. Well, imagine I'm running for the Senate in Indiana. And I go back and across state and I say, look, I've read the United States Constitution. If you elect me to the Senate, don't expect for me to bring back Meals on Wheels, aid to higher education, highway construction funds, because it's not authorized by the United States Constitution. Do you think I would get elected to the Senate from Indiana? No, I wouldn't. So, ladies and gentlemen, the blame is with us for the big problems that we face as a nation, because politicians are doing what we elect them to office do. Now, here's the tragedy of it. Indianans would be people of Indiana would be acting absolutely correct by not electing me to office, because what it means is that if I don't bring back billions of dollars, it doesn't mean that people of Indiana will pay a lower federal income tax. All that it means is that people of Illinois will get instead. That is, once legalized theft begins, it pays everybody to participate. And those who do not participate will wind up holding the brown end of the stick, if you get what I mean, if you're from a rural background. Let me close by saying that I don't know what the solutions are to our problems. The founders, if they were to come back, they would be very disappointed with us. But there's a little optimistic note, and that is, throughout our history, Americans have not done the wrong thing for a long time. We've managed to get our act together. But we better be about getting our act together while we still have the liberty to do so.
To start, we have a question about public safety. Do the functions of government entities such as the Food and Drug Administration or Federal Aviation Administration square with your interpretation of personal liberty and freedom?
Well, the issue of safety is very, very important. That is, it pays for Americans to know whether drugs are safe and whether they're effective. Now, the question is, is what kind of agency can best do that. And I think that there are real hazards of having a Food and Drug Administration because they have different kind of incentives than, let's say, Underwriters Laboratory. They approve or they certify the safety of electrical equipment within their private organization. Just very, very quickly, the Food and Drug Administrations, they have administrators, they have incentives to make the type 1 error. That is, they have the incentive to err on the side of overcaution. And because if they err on the side of undercaution and they have a bunch of thalidomide babies in Congress, then they're going to lose their jobs. But erring on the side, being too safe, means that many drugs are kept off the market and many Americans die as a response. And a good example of this was beta blockers that had been used in Europe and Japan for about 14 years that were denied use here. But, and it's estimated by several people who studied, roughly 10,000 Americans died each year unnecessarily because this beta blocker had not been approved for use in the United States. These are the mistakes that government officials like to make because these are invisible victims of their policy. That is, the people who died, they don't know why they died. Their loved ones don't know why they died. So the FDA official is off the hook in playing, in erring on the side of overcaution. So, but I think that the incentives of a private certification firm would be different from the FDA. So again, yes, to know that drugs are safe and effective is very, very important. Now the question is, how do we do that? And it's not clear that a government agency is the best way.
Without surprise, we have a number of questions about the presidential election candidates and their policies. Without asking you who we should vote for, which policies proposed by presidential candidates do you find the most troublesome?
I find all of them. It's just one is not as bad as the other. I think that in the next 4 years, our basic, the crisis will not be in economics. The crisis will be in foreign diplomacy. And I think that we have to look at, you know, a president that can handle the foreign diplomacy issues, such as Iran, North Korea, Russia, Venezuela. And I think that these will be the big issue. And I think that one candidate, the Republican candidate, I think he's better able in these in foreign diplomacy issue. But all of them are bad. Truly bad in terms of economic policy. I haven't heard a sensible economic policy from any of them. And it would only take one sentence for them to say, but it wouldn't be politically useful, is for a president to say, I am not going to interfere with peaceful voluntary exchange among the American people. But nobody has the guts to say that.
Maybe this is a follow-up. If you were going to play one-on-one basketball against Barack Obama, would you be willing to commit a charging foul just for the fun of it?
I would do things that would make him cry.
What would you suggest to be the first steps towards shrinking the federal government and its spending?
I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to get back to where we were, where governments respected the Constitution. I think my favorite president was is Grover Cleveland. And Grover Cleveland, he vetoed more legislation than during his two terms, which did not run consecutively, than all the presidents ahead of him combined. And very often his veto message carried, this is not authorized by the United States Constitution. And he just vetoed it and it just did not work. We don't have presidents like that anymore. And to give you an idea of what the founders thought about the Constitution, in 1794, Congress appropriated $15,000 to help some French refugees. And James Madison, stood on the floor of the House irate, and he said, and I'm virtually quoting him, that I cannot undertake to lay my finger on that article in the Constitution that permits Congress to spend the money of their constituents for the objects of benevolence. Now, that's the father of the Constitution, so he ought to know what's in there. And it turns out that two-thirds to three-quarters of our current spending is for the purposes of benevolence. And I think it's tragic, and I don't see how we can get back. And just one final thing. Check out freestateproject.org. On your website. This represents about 20,000, this represents a group of young people, and they're trying to get 20,000 Americans to move to the state of New Hampshire. Peaceably take over the legislature, elect congressmen and senators, negotiate with Congress to obey the United States Constitution, and if Congress fails to do so, some of them are suggesting, some of the people on freeproject.org, they're suggesting that we issue a unilateral declaration of independence. That is, that New Hampshire become a sovereign nation. Now, some people say, Williams, that's kind of troubling, sin, because we had a little problem in 1861 with secession. And I say, no. I say, well, that one didn't work. The first one in 1776 worked. So we're batting 500, and I like to see whether we can break the tie myself.
One person observed that if we all work until May 8th for the federal government, we have an additional reason to be happy to be here today on May 9th, and asks, do you still consider the United States to be a capitalist country? If not, what can we do to regain it?
Well, I think that for the most part, in general, we're the freest nation on the face of Earth. We're not the most free market nation. Hong Kong would beat us out, and I think the New Zealand would beat us out. And I think that United States might, in the Index of Economic Freedom, I think that United States ranks fifth or sixth. There are a number of countries, several countries ahead of us. But I think, ladies and gentlemen, that the way that we get back, and I don't have all the answers, but the way that we get back to being a free market nation, I think, is that if each of us asks less from government. You know, keep in mind, those of us who are Christians, we should find government spending obnoxious, because when God gave Moses the commandment, thou shalt not steal, he did not mean that thou shalt not steal unless you got a majority vote in Congress. Moreover, if you were to ask God, well, is it okay to be a recipient of stolen property? What do you think he would say? He'd probably say that's a sin as well. Wouldn't he? Thank you very much, folks.
That was Walter Williams speaking through the Economic Club of Indiana. Williams is an author, radio host, and professor of economics at George Mason University. He spoke to the club in May. Walter Williams believes the government should basically let the market rule the U.S. economy. However, other economists think that's not enough to ensure the nation's long-term economic health. Richard Steinberg is a professor of economics, philanthropic studies, and public affairs at IUPUI. Steinberg thinks a good balance between government and private roles in our economy is the best option.
I specialized in public economics in school, and since then I've worked extensively on understanding the role of nonprofit organizations and philanthropy. One of the key topics in public economics is what activities should be assigned to market institutions and what activities, including regulation and taxation, should be assigned to government. And there's a beautiful, logically coherent story we can tell with lots of details about exactly what the role of government should be. But it's beautiful in its simplification. The applicability of that to the real world is always a bit of an open question. So if we make the kinds of assumptions in those models, we know there are things that markets will do very well in terms of, if there's any opportunity for mutual advantage, the markets will find it. But there's some opportunities for mutual advantage that the market will systematically get wrong. And so in the traditional beautiful theory, this is where government is supposed to step in to fix market failure. So the first market failure that we would study would be external effects of market activities, such as the pollution created when I buy electric power from a power plant. The market doesn't take account of that, because although the electricity I'm buying is bought and sold and is part of the economic calculation of the buyer and seller, the pollution that it causes affects people without being part of anyone's calculation. The government has actually done much better than a cynic like me would expect on fixing the market's problems with respect to the environment. That said, I don't have a whole lot of faith in government these days. Maybe my faith will change as political circumstances change. But politics has toyed with environmental policy in a million ways, and there's a million stupid things we do because of politics, and it's still much better than it would be if government left the market for environmental regulation. So that's a relative success, even for a cynic. The second kind of thing, which is really related to the first kind of thing, is activities that benefit collectively a group. So if anyone buys it, everyone else in the group can enjoy it for free. That's called a collective good or a public good in the literature. And markets will systematically fail to provide the appropriate quantity of collective goods. And in part, that's because everybody, anyone could pay for it and the group benefits. Everyone waits until someone else pays for it. And in the end, there's too little paying for it by voluntary action. The purest kind of collective good, like national defense, has the additional property. Not only does buying an army help everyone in America, but you cannot fail to enjoy the safety the army provides, even if you don't pay for it. And that means markets couldn't charge money because you get to enjoy it just the same whether you pay or not. So markets just don't engage in that kind of activity for non-excludable collective good. And that's another clear role for government, and government does a good job relative to a cynic's expectation, but there's a million things we could all complain about. What's my research career has been taking this traditional economic model one step further. Markets fail, that's where government acts. But we also know that governments fail frequently. And there are some alternatives to both government and markets, and they're provided by nonprofit organizations and voluntary action, volunteering, giving, as well as other kinds of nonprofit and non-market enterprise. And in my field, I've contributed to the development of three failure theory, the idea that some activities are very well done by voluntary organizations that don't distribute their profits to owners. And when we have an activity that a voluntary agency would fail at, it could then be assigned to the government or to the private sector. So each sector fills in the weaknesses and gaps of the other. When you're all done, you have something better than any two-sector or one-sector model. But still, there are some things that we just don't know how to fix. And here's what we do know. If we run experiments called dictator or ultimatum or public good experiments, with people in primitive cultures that stress market exchange, in primitive cultures that stress tradition or independence, we'll find different behavior with respect to how people share in this experimental setting. And the consensus of a study in 15 relatively primitive societies was that one of the factors that consistently explained cooperation was a market orientation. And the theory was that you get used to exchanging goods being a mutually beneficial thing, so it made them more trusting and more familiar with the idea of my actions affecting others. That said, it's a long way from saying capitalism is necessary, minimal government regulation is necessary for people to give. if you try to forecast giving, there's some interesting things, including that giving is a little bit lower with Democrats in power and a little bit higher with Republicans in power. That suggests the different reliance on government versus voluntary solutions to problems of the two parties. It's reasonable to expect that when Republicans are in office, government will be doing less for the poor, and maybe that's a reason to spend more, to give more to charity, things like that. It's a small effect, and there are lots of other ways of getting at it, but it's interesting that it correlates with the party in power. And it suggests that it's a lot more complicated than just looking at capitalism and freedom as determinants of giving. If you look at some of the old Soviet client states, donations tend to be very low, but it's not because people are not altruistic. It's because people don't trust each other. They would be very generous with people they trust, but they've been in a society where trust in others was not well rewarded. So that's a factor that seems to matter a lot. Given that the politicians reflect exactly what the voters ask for, and the voters don't ask for very much, the last refuge for quality government is professional ethics of those who work for government in policy making and implementation procedures. And to the extent we can protect against political appointments and somehow encourage people with professional integrity to make the decisions and to be somewhat isolated, not entirely isolated from political pressures, I think our government will be able to better help the economy and the people of this country and the world.
Richard Steinberg is a professor of economics, public affairs, and philanthropic studies at IUPUI. Thanks for joining us for the 2007-2008 series of luncheon speakers from the Economic Club of Indiana in downtown Indianapolis. The new season begins in September. The series is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting. The engineer is Colleen Udis. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.